Good afternoon. Welcome once again to Line One, your health connection from Alaska Public Media in Anchorage, Alaska. I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. Ear, nose, and throat physician are especially trained in disorders of the speech, hearing, and balance, as well as some of the other problems of the head and neck. In today's program, we're going to discuss these disorders of speech, hearing, and balance with Dr. Stephen Schaefer and Dr. Mark Lorenz. Dr. Schaefer has a special interest in voice disorders, given his background in singing, and his office is the only one in Alaska that uses something called a video strobe to diagnose vocal cord and larynx disorders. Dr. Mark Lorenz has special training in addition to ENT in complex surgery of hearing and balance disorders. Particularly important is his ability to now provide a local option for the use of cochlear implants, which restore some sense of hearing to those patients who are deaf or otherwise profoundly have hearing loss. During the next hour, you can reach us during this period of time while we're here in the studio in a couple of ways. Our local number, 550-8433, 550-8433. Toll-free number is 1-888-353-5752. And your email address is line1@alaskapublic.org. You have to spell out the line one, L-I-N-E-O-N-E, all one word, line1@alaskapublic.org. Dr. Schaefer, Dr. Lorenz, nice to have you here. It's a pleasure.
Thanks for having
us. Thank you.
This is a tough first question for both of you. We don't have, we're not on TV, so it's radio, and I need to help you guys, help our listeners understand these rather complex organs of hearing and balance and vocal production. Mark, I'm going to have you start by telling me about how the ear functions to transmit or recept a sound and get it to the brain, and then a little bit about balance as well.
Sure. Well, the ear is a very interesting place. There are two basic functions provided by our ears. Hearing is the one that most people think of when they think of an ear. Basically, sound waves are funneled by the auricle, which is the outer ear, down the ear canal, where then it hits the eardrum, which is a thin piece of skin at the end of the ear canal that sends vibrations through the ossicles and into the cochlea, which, by the way, is the hardest bone in your body. That information that reaches the cochlea is then transmitted from mechanical sound into electrical impulses that are transmitted to the brain. The second principal function of your ear is for maintenance of balance. We have three semicircular canals as part of our inner ear that detect angular acceleration, such as when you turn your head. And there's also two paired gravity sensing organs called the otolithic organs. Those are the utricle and saccule. They detect linear acceleration, such as when your momentum changes forward and backwards or up and down, like when you're in an elevator. Those two functions will actually constantly be firing in your inner ears at both times, pushing against each other, and your brain is able to decipher that information and interpret it as balance. And in addition to that, there's a lot of important structures in the ear. Your carotid artery, your jugular vein are there. There's nerves that control taste on half your tongue. You have the nerve that provides the stimulation to your lacrimal gland and your salivary glands. And there's even the large nerve that helps you move your face and provides facial expression.
For listeners, if you go to alaskapublic.org and get the Line 1 link in our website, today there are some web resources. It would help everybody a lot if they had some idea of the anatomy. It's difficult. It's easy to find pictures of these things, but particularly a good, excellent video that I've incorporated on there shows about how the ear functions to transfer sound into the brain. I thought it was particularly good. But there's a number of websites like that. And how big is the cochlea? Let's get some perspective on size for people.
Probably slightly larger than a pea, but smaller than a dime.
Wow. Wow, and you're nowadays can do what amazes me is you're replacing some of those middle ear ossicles or bones. You're fixing those. You're can operate in there.
Yeah, it's all done with microscopes, and we take pretty precise measurements. The prosthetics we put in are usually within a quarter millimeter in length, and so even a half millimeter or quarter millimeter off size can lead to disaster in the operating room. So right. We're pretty precise when we do our work.
All right. So what we're going to do is we're going to kind of oscillate ourselves back and forth between some of these issues of the middle ear and the inner ear and what Dr. Lorenz specializes in working on, and also talk with Dr. Schaefer about the larynx and vocal cords and so forth. So I'm going to ask him if he wouldn't mind describing the function and maybe a little bit of the anatomy of our larynx as well.
Sure, I'll try to do that. It's obviously a three-dimensional structure. It's a little hard to explain, but it's a structure of cartilage and muscle. And the voice box, first of all, has a V-shaped cartilage called the thyroid cartilage, and that's what we call the voice box. Just below this is a round cricoid cartilage that sits atop the windpipe or the trachea. Within the voice box, on top of the cricoid, are two small L-shaped cartilages called the arytenoid cartilages. They're moved by several muscles, and there is a ligament that is attached from the arytenoid to the thyroid cartilage that will move in a V-shaped formation, and this forms the, this is the vocal cords, and this forms what we call the glottis, or the opening. Cords themselves are made up of a muscle called the vocalis, and it's covered in a fascia, and along the free edge of that, which we call the vocal ligament. And then overlying this ligament is an elastic fluid structure of mucosa and connective tissue, which we'll call the cover. And the cover vibrates and moves, and this is what gives us our pitch and beauty of tone. And this is probably the most important structure of voice production. Mm-hmm. So produce sound, the diaphragm contracts, a column of air comes, vibrates across the vocal cords. That sound is transmitted up into the face, our tongue, and our teeth, lips form this into speech. And then the hollow sinus cavities and nasal chamber give extra resonance that add beauty to the sound.
You know, I can sit here, I guess maybe partly because I'm a physician, I can look at the ear, I can understand how the eardrum vibrates, as Dr. Lorenz mentions, and conducts sound through the three bones, and it moves some fluid over hairs, and but it blows me away. I don't quite understand how we learn to control vocal cords so innately, and I can't sing, so I assume people get even better and better at controlling their vocal cords. It just seems phenomenal to me. I mean, you can't see them, and yet we learn how to make very, very precise sounds with vocal cords.
Yes, it's amazing structure. Yeah, it is.
We also have a video strobe examination of the vocal cords and function action on the website. So if you go to line one, it's an amazing picture to watch the different sounds being made. So our nasal pharynx also can affect the sound quality of what's coming out of our voice box.
Yes, it can. Just for instance, if you have a child with large adenoids that sit in the nasal pharynx and prevent sound from reverberating up through the nasal cavity will give you what they call a hyponasal sound. It sounds like your nose is pinched.
So things that might be in the back of the throat, like tonsils and adenoids and other mm-hmm. things, can begin to affect not only how you breathe, but how the quality of your voice right. sounds.
A sinusitis, a cold, anything that fills the sinuses with fluid will obviously affect vibration as well.
What about special equipment? Mark, Dr. Lorenz, let's come back to you. Is there something more in addition to what the most common ear, nose, and throat, or what typical ear, nose, and throat specialists are doing that you need to do your job?
I'd say the most important things for me in clinic are having a microscope that's specially designed to look at ears and a set of tuning forks for basic hearing screening. The remainder of my work is usually informed by imaging studies like MRI scans or CAT scans. Sometimes I'll get a special test called a VNG, which is a specific balance test. An interesting fact about the ear is that in the normal condition, if one inner ear is even a degree different in terms of temperature than the other, your body will actually perceive that as motion. Because of that phenomenon, you can flush warm and cold air into the ears while recording eye motions, which respond to that sensation of turning, and you can evaluate the relative strength of a person's inner ears.
Given the same principle, you can squirt hotter, warmer, or cold water in and make somebody pretty nauseated.
Yeah.
Right.
The guy that figured that out won a Nobel Prize,
oh,
actually.
Really? Yeah. Right. All right. What about you, Steve? I know we're going to talk about the videos or the stroboscope and using that to take pictures of the larynx. What else do you use? And then tell us specifically what that instrument can do for you.
Well, the video stroboscope is really my primary instrument that I use in the clinic. It's a wonderful piece. It utilizes a laryngoscope, which is very common in ENT clinics, which is a flexible scope, got fiber optics and a light source, allows us to pass a scope through the nasal cavity up and around and look directly down onto the voice box. The video stroboscope, what is different about it, it actually uses a strobe light. And here's the reason. The vocal cords vibrate at hundreds of times a second. And all the human eye can appreciate is just a blur. Mm-hmm. However, if you use a strobe light and it's coordinated to the pitch or the frequency of the voice, you can actually present the number of images seen by the eye to less than 5 images a second. And this is what the human can perceive, and we actually then see the cord in slow motion. And this slowing down of the cords allows us to see very intricate details of vibration, particularly of the cover structure that I mentioned earlier. And it improves our ability to make a good diagnosis.
Mm-hmm. So it's definitely something that enables you to have a more precise picture of what's going on, therefore able to detect what's going on than you could do with just visually looking at the cord.
Yes. We use this on video, which allows us to review it, because often it's complicated and it takes a long time.
Yeah. All right. Let me remind listeners once again, our topic today are disorders of speech, hearing, and balance. My guests are Dr. Stephen Schaefer and Dr. Mark Lorenz. If you have questions or comments about something you hear, you have a problem that you'd like some opinion on, why don't you try to give us a call? Our local number, 550-8433, toll-free number 1-888-353-5752. And our email address is line1@alaskapublic.org. So, Mark, you really, I don't know if you call yourself a neuro-otologist, or, which is a kind of a further subspecialization of ENT. And if so, what does that designation mean?
So just like you said, neuro-otology is a subspecialty after you complete an ear, nose, and throat residency. It focuses on diseases of the inner ear and auditory nerve. During the training, we receive experience and education in all manners of issues and problems related to disease of the ear, balance, facial nerve, and auditory nerve. I spent a lot of time during my fellowship with cochlear implant patients, auditory brainstem implants, congenital deafness, balance disorders, facial paralysis, and different tumors and cancers of the ear.
So is the extra training required just because of the difficulty of operating in this pea-sized organ?
Yeah, that's about right. I mean, you don't have much room for error.
Yeah. All right. So but without a neuro-otologist, then the logical thought is that kind of problem would be referred outside of Alaska. And so having you as a neuro-otologist allows a lot of these other much more complex surgeries with much more potential for complications over to be done locally.
Exactly. There's been a number of patients since I've started that would have been sent to Seattle that were able to treat them in town. And they greatly appreciate not having to leave town for that.
Let's jump real quickly. I have a caller on the line, but I want to talk about the cochlear implants. What's the implication for a cochlear implant? What's the kind of patient that needs a cochlear implant? When's it used? How does a cochlear implant work? In 5 minutes or less.
That's a broad question. Well, personally, I think if we have one miracle procedure in ENT, cochlear implants are probably it. What it is, it's actually an implantable electrical device with a thin stimulating wire that's placed directly into the cochlea. From what we know about the cochlea, we can generally predict where neurons are that provide high-frequency information and low-frequency sound information. And that electrode that we put in has multiple little contact points which stimulate those neurons directly with a very low voltage current. And that's eventually carried on toward the brain and perceived as sound. When you put in the internal device, there's still an external component that looks like a regular hearing aid attached to a magnet. And what that is a speech processor that interprets sound and, again, converts it into electrical information that's sent through a current. Currently in the United States, implants are for both children and adults with very severe or profound hearing loss who receive little benefit from regular hearing aids. In order to be even considered a candidate for a cochlear implant, a patient has to be very hard of hearing, have tried unsuccessfully with regular hearing aids, and at least have an imaging study of some sort that shows they have a patent cochlea that can accommodate the wire. The outcomes from cochlear implants, they vary quite a bit. Basically, you would not expect the same outcome from implantation in a deaf adult who didn't develop speech skills the same way as someone who grew up with just a functioning cochlea. They just don't have the same patterns of synapses in their brain after when they compare it to a patient who has had a lifetime of normal speech. As a general rule, when you identify a child who's deaf, the younger the patient is at the time of implantation, the better their speech and language skills develop. So in terms of your question of outcomes, what can you expect with an implant? More than half of adults who were deafened after they developed normal speech patterns are able to use a telephone after a cochlear implant. It's really an amazing procedure. It can change lives. It offers an escape from social isolation that many adults who have hearing loss experience. It's pretty straightforward in terms of surgery. It takes usually about an hour to 2 hours. And the biggest risk of doing it is it's a surgically implanted electrical device, and we rely on the device functioning for your lifetime. The warranties on those internal devices they all exceed 10 years across the different brands, but we do occasionally see hardware failures. And when that's the case, we just swap it out for a new one. One general concern that patients, when they're considering a cochlear implant, deal with is that the technology is constantly changing. Just like cell phones will be different next year, cochlear implant technology has improved quite a bit in the last decade, and it's going to continue to improve. The surgery itself, it interferes with your ability to use conventional hearing aids in addition to that. And another interesting question that I wonder sometimes is what if we start using stem cell therapies to regrow damaged aspects of the inner ear? Will having a cochlear implant prevent those patients from being candidates for that type of therapy? I don't know. I get asked that. Right. I get asked questions about that all the time, and I think that technology is at least 10 years out.
I think the general perception about stem cells from the public is that it does a lot more than they really do at this particular time. It has a lot of promise, but there's not a lot, you know, within the cancers. And there's recently been some eye issues that have been improved, but we're still a long way.
I think for deafness, cochlear implants are basically a cure, and they're a miracle cure.
Yeah. So could we focus just a second again on the criteria, and I guess what I'm trying to get at is help people understand why, if you've had hearing loss for a long, long period of time, why a cochlear implant is going to have less impact on you, especially particularly with related to speech, than someone who has had a recent loss of hearing, say from trauma.
Sure. Well, just like if you had a paralyzed limb and it wasn't active for a number of years, it would take a lot of training to redevelop strength in that limb. The same is true in your auditory cortex. If you're not using your temporal lobe the same way, if you're not using your auditory nerve, you lose some of the synapses and connections that help you perceive and process sound. So if you're deaf, waiting a long time before intervention is not necessarily a good thing. Hearing is basically like any kind of muscle. If you don't use it, you would lose it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I like to think of it, the brain kind of, in a sense, at least from, I think of it from a pediatric standpoint, as you develop, if you're not getting stimulated, that the brain, in a sense, prunes away a lot of neurons. It just purely can be from an energy way. Why you use energy to keep something going that's really not being stimulated at all?
Yeah, that's a good way to think about it.
All right, we have a caller. Thomas, you're on line one. What can we do for you? Tom, you still there? I think we must have lost him. All right. Stephen, let's come back to you and talk about the larynx a little bit. What is probably one of the more common disorders of the larynx that you run into, and can you help us understand what's happening?
Well, laryngitis. Mm-hmm. Laryngitis is probably the most common thing that we see in the clinic. It basically, itis implies inflammation of the vocal cords, which gives you symptoms of hoarseness. Glottal fry, which is a term speech therapists use to describe kind of a rattle to the voice, like you hear it when mm-hmm. I'm talking right there. That's called glottal fry. There's often a change in voice pitch. All of these things are seen as hoarseness. This can be viral, bacterial, or fungal in cause. It can be actually infectious, but it can also have non-infectious causes like acid reflux, sometimes medications, chemical exposures, and even phonotrauma, which would be overuse, abuse of the voice. Mm-hmm. It's probably one of the more common things I see is the latter.
I've never had problems with my voice at all, and I am now 67, and I notice after certain days my voice is much different than it was earlier, and I understand that that's part of aging as well. Is that normal or not? Might as well get my free consult, too.
There's probably all kinds of things that happen to the voice with aging. The most profound one that I see is vocal cord bowing that you will see in patients of the age of 55, not universally, but for some it can be quite severe. There is a tension placed across the cords. They're like a ligament, a rubber band, and that tension will decrease with age. And so when the vocal cords come together, they will bow out. Well, that necessarily creates an ellipse of air right in the center of the vocal cords or the glottis that allows air escape. Mm-hmm. And so it adds a little bit of air. It's almost like a whispered sound. So the symptoms of that is you have an airiness or hoarseness to the voice. It's very hard to yell. You try to yell and you just, you get a little whimper mm-hmm. out when you mm-hmm. try to yell. Mm-hmm. And you fatigue. Mm-hmm. The reason why is because of that inefficient glottis and that waste of air. You actually waste air when you're speaking, and so your lung volume is finite, and a sentence or a phrase that you used to be able to say in one breath, suddenly it takes two or three, and that can be quite fatiguing when you're in conversation.
Mm-hmm. What about if your voice is changing, it's consistently long-term, it's been there for a while, I would think there might be some other physical abnormalities of the cord, and, you know, in older people, we might think of cancer or we've heard of nodules and so forth. How do those things present?
Well, everybody's heard of, I think, of vocal cord nodules mm-hmm. or Singer's nodules. And vocal cord nodules, they're tiny bilateral thickenings of the mucosal cover of the vocal cords. It's usually on both cords. And it causes the cords to high-end and keep them from coming together. So this thickening is usually along the free edge, and we call it an hourglass larynx because instead of the cords lining up perfectly, they high-end at that spot. That causes air escape both in front and in back of the nodules and leads to hoarseness. The thickenings are very similar histologically to a callus, and it's caused by persistent or chronic misuse of the cords, and this usually forms over months to years of poor vocal practice. It's very common in singers and actors, people that yell a lot, mm-hmm. public speakers. And I also see it in people that do a lot or excessive coughing. So it's the most common cause of hoarseness in children. Now, there is something similar. You can get a polyp or a mucosal cyst on the cords. This is usually caused by phonotrauma. It's usually an acute injury. So if you had an acute loss of voice after a weekend of yelling at the kids' soccer games or something like that, this is something that we would often find. And polyps and cysts usually require removal for complete resolution. They rarely resolve on their own. Nodules usually need the involvement of voice therapy or speech therapy because it takes a long time, but they eventually resolve with change in voice habits.
Mark, I want to come back to you again about the cochlear implant. What we heard you say and what I understand is that it's recommended for individuals who've had some problems for a while with their hearing. The cochlea has to be fairly functional because we're going to put these wires in there. And that kids that have had hearing loss for a long time, we've told listeners, begin to not respond as well if you put a cochlear implant in so that now they can hear better and they can develop voice. So it would seem where I'm going with this is that the earlier, the younger kids would be good candidates. But I don't hear you, I don't hear that being said is one of the criteria, getting kids in there, getting it done in really, really young kids. Can you talk about why that may be?
Well, I guess I should have said that because that's absolutely true. We generally, if we identify a kid with congenital deafness, we'll try to have a cochlear implant in at some point between the ages of 1 and 2. The younger, the better, but there's a limit to that. The implant themselves, they're about the size of a book of matches, and for really young children, like under 6 months, and there's even a guy in Italy that puts implants in children who are 2 and 4 months of age, having even elective surgery can be pretty high risk. So in general, when we identify a child with just congenital deafness, and it's always got to be, by the way, sensory neural loss, which is meaning that the inner ear itself is not functioning well or the nerve of hearing is not working as it should. If we identify a child with that type of hearing loss, usually the goal is to get hearing aids on them relatively quickly and then anticipate a cochlear implant early if hearing aids are not helpful for them.
I got you. All right. So, yeah, so that makes sense to me. So the physical size of the equipment as we have it right now is a limitation, and then we can continue to preserve some hearing and speech by getting hearing aids on early while you wait for the size.
You just wait a little while for a hearing aid trial, and then also because the risks of neonatal anesthesia are much higher than when you're putting a child who's 1 under anesthesia, just the ease of surgery, the ease of anesthesia, the safety of the procedure, they all go up by just waiting just a few more months.
I'm going to take a break shortly, and this may be a question, unfortunately, that I don't know if you really have an answer for it, but it seems to me remarkable that somebody figured this out. Do you have any understanding in your training of how somebody figured out that they could put some wires into the cochlea and initiate hearing?
Oh, they experimented on cats. It wasn't me, and that was in the 70s.
Wow.
And,
So the idea has been around for a while.
Yeah, but the guy who first developed them, his name was he worked with somebody, but one of the really pioneers in ear surgery, his name was Bill House. He developed a monochannel cochlear implant, which is just an electrical wire that went into a patient's ear and provided a single burst of electricity whenever there was sound. So I imagine something that what they heard was more like Morse code compared to what new hearing aids or new cochlear implants are actually able to divide up those different frequencies so you can hear voices. But a lot of people were shocked when he first presented that data. And it's the type of project that takes a lot of endurance, a lot of energy to get going. I don't even know if it'd be possible to organize that type of procedure and that type of research nowadays. But he was a real pioneer.
Mm-hmm. It would seem to me is that the size of these things will almost certainly come down. If I look at a computer, that we ought to be able to get these things smaller and smaller and smaller.
Yeah, the wires are very thin. Uh-huh. They're like about maybe as a bundled couple pieces of dental floss together, but they're really thin, very flexible, and the reason they are that way is so you can advance them deep into the cochlea without causing lots of damage to the cochlea. Again, to preserve the ear if future technologies change.
Mm-hmm. Oh gosh, I didn't even think about damaging the cochlea when you're threading those things up there. We'll come back to that. I need to take a break.
Okay.
You're listening to Line One, your health connection. Our local number again, 550-8433. A toll free number, 1-888-353-5752. Our email address, line1@alaskapublic.org. We're going to take a very short break, roughly a minute, and we'll continue our conversation on neurootology and laryngology with Dr. Stephen Schaefer and Dr. Mark Lorenz. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard.
You're listening to Line One from Alaska Public Media. The program repeats tonight at 8 p.m. on KSKA Anchorage and will not be taking phone calls. You can find Line One on iTunes or listen at alaskapublic.org.
Welcome back. This is Line One, your health connection from Alaska Public Media in Anchorage, Alaska, and I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. Today's program is focusing on some disorders of the larynx where issues of voice and breathing, swallowing can originate, and also disorders of balance and hearing. Up to this point, we've pretty much talked about the voice, and we've talked a little bit about hearing, and particularly the use of something called a cochlear implant that can improve the or reestablish some hearing in certain patients. Our guests are otolaryngologists, that's ENT physicians, Dr. Stephen Schaefer and Dr. Mark Lorenz. If you've got questions, there are a couple of ways you can get in touch with us. Our email address is line1@alaskapublic.org. Our local number, 550-8433, our toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. And always remember, if you're listening to a program in the evening, now between 8 and 9, you're listening to a taped rebroadcast, so we will not be able to answer that question for you. However, if you're listening then or you want to listen again, you can always go to our archives at alaskapublic.org and even refer your friends or relatives if you want them to hear a program. A lot of our older programs are still available for your listening at the time you want to do it. Dr. Schaefer, we had a question come in by email that says, I have issues with wheezing and constriction of my vocal cords. Are there exercises I can do to help loosen the cords? It tends to happen when I'm exposed to cold air or when I'm breathing heavily. What do you think's going on? What's this listener talking about?
Well, it sounds like one of the diagnoses that I see in clinic often and is often seen in asthma and pulmonology clinics is something called vocal cord dysfunction. These are patients, sometimes they're previously given a diagnosis of asthma or they have a coexisting condition of asthma. And asthma is constriction in the bronchioles, actually in the lungs itself. But some people have normal lungs, and when they do pulmonary function tests, it comes back as normal. And this is a rather new diagnosis relatively. It's the last 20 years or so has gained a lot of traction, where we're seeing something called vocal cord dysfunction, and this is an abnormality of vocal cord movement. So abduction is where the vocal cords open which would open widely to allow you to inhale deeply. Sometimes it doesn't open up as well as it should. And so when you breathe in, you're breathing through a constricted glottis. It often makes a sound called stridor, which is kind of a type of sound when you're breathing in. It certainly constricts the airway volume, the amount of air going in, and so patients feel like they're short of breath. And it's a common reason for people to come to the emergency room. You see it in all ages. See it from teenagers up to adults.
So the person who wrote this in used the term wheezing and constriction, and I find that it's often helpful, to, just like you did, to define the terms, because sometimes the patients are using words with having a different meaning than we do. Stridor is an inspiratory high-pitched sound. Wheezing is usually expiratory. I can do something with my vocal cords. Okay. So it's different, and it means different things. One is having air come in and vocal cord dysfunction. Anybody does a lot of asthma, it's sudden onset. Usually they may occur, like you said, with or without asthma. And and there are ways to get people to relax those things. I know the allergists here have a speech and language speech therapist that spends a lot of time helping lots of people learn to relax their vocal cords.
Yes, this has actually become quite a teaching tool of speech therapists. Mm-hmm. And it's long and complicated. I couldn't explain it all here. Mm-hmm. But part of it is also teaching a person not to panic or because if the cords are constricted and you take a deep breath, so much air is being funneled across the cords that it worsens the stridor, actually makes the problem worse. Mm-hmm. There's a strong feeling of I have to breathe deeper, and so it brings on anxiety. And part of it is just knowing what's going on in your cords and trying to control your breathing will often help. A vocal cord dysfunction usually breaks or changes within several minutes if you can control your breathing.
I know when I first got into doing asthma and was recognizing that this was something that, as you said, could be together with asthma or occur independently and be misdiagnosed as asthma. We saw lots of – I remember one kid in particular came in, was on lots and lots of medication, not getting better, who didn't have any asthma whatsoever. So it's one of those things that you can really make a big impact on. By recognizing it, and it can make asthma seem worse than it really is. So helping people understand the difference between symptoms in their neck and their chest, for example, can help. But I remember, again, the exercises, and I am not an expert on this, but at the time we were doing it, before we'd send everybody over to the speech therapist, it was like a pursed lip breathing. You kind of, or say S's slowly. It kind of relaxes the neck muscles. I think. I don't want to misinform this individual, but I think that was part of this early suggestions for this.
Pursing the lips or breathing through the nose.
Okay.
There's smaller volumes of air and so it helps to kind of indirectly decrease the amount of airflow across the cords.
Yeah. And I think cold air and noxious chemicals and things, lots of things can even, allergies can even cause the vocal cords to do this sometimes.
Reflux, anxiety. Mm-hmm. A lot of times, vocal cord dysfunction seems to come on during exertional events.
Yep.
We'll have kids when they're running races suddenly develop an asthma-like event that, after studies, isn't asthma. Yep. And this is where we kind of narrow the diagnosis.
Let's see. I think we had another email question. Dr. Lance, I guess we'll address to you is wanted to know something about vertigo. What does the term vertigo mean, and how is it related, let's say, to the inner ear?
Sure. Well, usually when I use the term vertigo, I'm referring to the sensation, or at least the illusion, that there's motion when you're not actually moving. For some patients, that can actually mean having the visual sensation of seeing the world spin around them, just like they got off a tilt-a-whirl and are standing still and everything's still pulling one direction. Or some patients use it comparable to the sensation you might get after being on a boat all afternoon and then getting back on land, that sensation of seasickness. The reason, so my particular interest in it is the fact that the balance system is connected to the organ of hearing in the inner ear. The two are the same. And so many different disorders are linked both with hearing loss and balance issues. There are some that are just balance related. There are some that are just hearing related. But usually the two go hand in hand.
I'll come back to my age again. It seems like as I get older that balance is not as good as it used to be. And I understand, although it's happened to me, that lots of people fall when they get older and they break bones a lot. And I was listening to a podcast not too long ago. In England, they have nothing but a fracture clinic that's designed to help identify the reasons why somebody falls. Because once they've fallen, they're probably going to fall again. And it's a tremendous expense to have all of these multiple fractures and sometimes head injuries. So does balance get worse with age, or am I different, or what can I do to prevent it if it's happening to somebody else out there?
I don't think you're
be
too
careful,
different.
Okay.
So when you're born, you are born with a finite number of hair cells in the inner ear that detect both hearing and balance. And just like elderly patients are predisposed, not that you're elderly, but just like elderly patients are predisposed towards hearing loss, those number of balance cells tend to deteriorate with time. That being said, balance isn't just the inner ear. It's affected by visual cues and sensory cues obtained from nerves in our joints. For instance, I can close my eyes and I know my legs are crossed because of input from the joints in my knee. Likewise, when I'm walking, I can see the floor is level and I know the height of my steps from my vision. Decline in vision due to cataracts or decline in sensation due to knee replacements or joint injuries both contribute to balance problems in older patients. In terms of the inner ear, we do experience loss in function over time. It's abnormal to be experiencing vertigo, but to have worsened balance as you age is unfortunately just very typical.
Right. And you may have said this. Sometimes I'm looking at too many things here. Vertigo is different than dizziness in the sense that vertigo is the sense that the room is actually spinning around. And sometimes, again, communication between patients and physicians is not the same. And that means different things to people.
Yeah. One thing I always do when I'm evaluating a patient with vertigo is trying to tease out what a patient means when they say vertigo. Is it lightheadedness, like when mm-hmm. you stand up quickly and you feel that rush of blood to your head? Mm-hmm. Is it the sensation of actually seeing things move and they're not moving? Is it the sense that you're going to fall when you're standing? And maybe you have diabetic neuropathy in your feet, and mm-hmm. part of the reason you have that sensation is that you just don't feel your feet like you should. Right. So that a lot of the examination and neurotology is based on clinical history and trying to get down to what patients are telling you about their balance dysfunction.
When I think of vertigo, the times I've seen it has been usually post-infectious. Particularly, I saw it once in a kid with chickenpox. They don't even want to get off the table.
Yeah, it is.
You think you can't walk.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, it's pretty nasty stuff.
It might be fun without the nausea.
All right, we got another caller. Teetra, you're on line one. What can we do for you?
Hello, good afternoon. I'm actually a physician in town, and Dr. Lorenz, you and I have a mutual patient. I'm an aeromedical physician, and I'm very interested in the problem of dizziness and pilots, knowing that there's, umpteen different kinds of dizziness. I'm wondering if you could maybe address an approach to how to deal with a person who's already gone to their family doctor and had the standard antihistamines and tincture of thyme, especially in recurrent dizziness, and especially in those types of dizzinesses that don't seem to have, the hallmarks of diagnoses that we're familiar with, like Meniere's disease and things like that. The folks that I seem to deal with are people who have intermittent dizziness, maybe with hearing changes or not hearing changes, maybe with tinnitus, but sort of vague, but it just comes and goes.
Sure.
I wonder if you could help me with an approach to that, knowing that one of the most important things for a pilot is whether or not these are conditions that are going to resolve or if they are going to recur. The prognosis is also very important. Thank you.
Yeah, so I think you touched on one of the major algorithm dividing points. If a patient is coming in, they're complaining of auditory symptoms at the same time as dizziness, that that usually suggests peripheral vertigo. And I think that's probably the essence of your question, trying to decipher what's peripheral vertigo, meaning what's related to inner ear dysfunction, and what's central vertigo, what's not. So again, if someone comes in complaining of auditory symptoms, ear pressure, ringing in the ear at the same time as having vertigo, that usually leads me down the route to thinking of a peripheral vestibular dysfunction. Now, it's also involves a lot of physical exam and a lot of clinical history. Probably about 90% of decision-making and management of balance disorders is based on clinical history. If a patient has a description of dizziness that is worse after a car accident and also has neck sprain, then you can assume that they have some form of cervicogenic vertigo. Just, again, we rely on those sensory nerves in our neck to tell us the positioning of our heads. If a patient comes in and is a horribly controlled diabetic and they have no sensation whatsoever in their feet and they complain of dizziness when they walk, then I think you can attribute that safely to their diabetic neuropathy, and treatment of that is more so managed or directed towards management of their diabetes. Specifically to your question of pilots, now that is a particularly dicey area for management of balance disorders, and the FAA watches that pretty closely. First off, you do have to look into that to see if that is actually vertigo of peripheral nature or not, and you have to manage it very closely because typically the FAA will ground pilots while they're actively having episodes of dizziness. Did I answer your question?
Well, yeah, I mean, very good. Thank you. I'm just wondering how you can make statements regarding prognosis and potential recurrences. And that's probably an unfair question to ask because it's a very broad question. But
if I'm able to specifically label the diagnosis and start treatment towards it, and a patient hasn't been symptomatic for, I think the FAA requests 6 months, but I'd have to double check that. If they've been asymptomatic after 6 months of treatment, then I think that they are released to flight status again.
And it also depends on the diagnosis and what medications they're on. Thank you.
Yeah, there's progressive inner ear diseases that we don't have cures for, but the ones that we are able to treat, if we're able to control symptoms, then usually we feel okay about it.
Thank you.
Sure.
Steve, I want to come back to you, Dr. Schaefer, and talk about the larynx again. You mentioned laryngeal reflux, and I suspect there's patients who don't think about voice changes as being related to what I guess the public will say is GERD. Could you help us understand that a little bit?
The most common type of reflux talked about is gastroesophageal reflux, and with these classic symptoms, probably gastritis, heartburn, acid taste in the mouth. Well, there is a different diagnosis subset called laryngopharyngeal reflux, or LPR, and the symptoms are more subtle. Symptoms that we'll commonly encounter: cough, throat clearing, feeling of something in the throat, thick mucus, hoarseness. We know acid is refluxing subtly because of pH probe studies of the upper esophagus, and this is a frequent diagnosis in the ENT clinic when patients present with feelings of throat discomfort. Now, a formal diagnosis of LPR requires a dual pH probe, which has an upper esophageal sensor. It's difficult to perform, however, and it's very hard for patients to tolerate, so you don't often see us do it. Often patients are empirically placed on a reflux medication called a proton pump inhibitor or an H2 blocker. To see if they will improve.
Yeah, so sometimes the testing is almost worse than the problem, or more expensive, and so forth. Yeah. So a therapeutic trial can be helpful in seeing if it fits and responds appropriately. We just assume that's what the problem is.
Exactly. You can have some very profound changes, though. The esophageal inlet lies adjacent to the vocal cords. Mm-hmm. And so if you're having any reflux, it causes, I mean, your larynx is not geared for acid.
Right.
And so you will see mucosal reactions that dramatically change the way the larynx looks, the way the vocal cord vibrate, and the sound that's produced can be impressive.
Just from the irritation of those foreign substances, so to speak. Shouldn't be there.
Yes.
All right. So here's one open to both of you. It's an email. It says, for years I've been, I occasionally get nausea that can last for days, but usually I take Sudafed, and in 20 minutes I'm fine. Wood smoke or seasonal allergies can trigger this sensation. If I have other allergy or irritation symptoms such as postnasal drip, runny nose, I don't have the nausea. When nauseous, I often get a sense of more congestion over and above what causes what may happen with a stuffy nose. What's going on up there? The reader is. Since it's similar to how I feel with motion sickness, I assume it's something affecting my balance system.
So they take Sudafed for nausea.
Yeah, but he's also, in a sense, what I'm hearing him say is he's also nauseated and congested, so he thinks it's related to, you know, a seasickness kind of feeling, motion sickness, he says.
Yeah, well, it might be. Sudafedrin is a stimulant, and it's not good to be on that every day if that's what that person was suggesting. But anyway, it's a stimulant, just like some patients, if you miss your morning cup of coffee, you might be a little bit more predisposed towards feeling off balance. The same is true if you've missed your Sudafed, I guess, and you've been taking it every day for years.
I guess what I'm hearing here and maybe how he's describing it is if you are congested and stuffy, can that affect your sense of balance and maybe make you feel like you have motion sickness?
I call that brain fog.
Oh, okay. Not exactly the same thing.
No.
Okay. All right. And what's the problem with taking Sudafed all the time?
Oh, it has pretty profound effects on blood pressure. It's addictive. There's rebound when you stop it. It's generally not a healthy thing for your body.
There's another email. My parents are 92, live independently in Anchorage, and are relatively good health. Both have significant hearing loss and hearing aids. They work moderately well for my mother. However, the hearing aids provide a little benefit for my father. He's unable to hear telephone conversation, increasingly isolated in social situations. Can cochlear implants be done in patients over 90?
Sure. Yeah. I think the oldest I've placed would be 97. And it depends on the general health of the person, if they're able to tolerate a general anesthetic for about an hour and a half. So if someone's got significant cardiac comorbidities or other reasons they can't go under anesthesia, that's a concern. The other concern that most patients or that we'll have with patients of advanced age who get cochlear implants is there is a period of retraining after you get the implant. It's not, you don't just put it in, turn it on, and hear great. It usually does take a few months of practice and programming. And that plasticity of your brain that you were alluding to earlier is not quite as robust when you're in your mid-90s. But still, it depends on the patient. And there's a lot of older patients that do great with cochlear implants. Lets them reintegrate.
Are there payment problems with trying to get a cochlear implant in somebody his age?
Medicare accepts it as surgically acceptable.
Okay. I was just wondering if there were limitations because of age that might make it difficult.
We have to clarify it with Medicare before each case, but we're usually good.
All right. Here's another one that may not be in our bailiwick, but I thought we ought to answer the question. I've had 2 years of becoming shortness of breath when speaking. Speech is very breathy sounding. I have a history of sarcoidosis, which is in remission. Pulmonary function tests are normal. Chest x-rays normal. Very disruptive to my life. Very difficult to read to my daughter at night without coming short of breath. Any suggestions about what to do next?
First, I'd want to know the age of the patient. And then secondly, is it extrapulmonary sarcoidosis?
Right.
Was the sarcoid involving the larynx? Because it can certainly do that. Right. And that would, if that's the case, it interferes greatly with vibration of the vocal cords.
Yeah, so this is a situation where there's a lot of potential problems. It's hard to tell in my mind, although you're the ENT, that whether this is originating from his chest or whether it's in his larynx or somewhere he's having problems. But if it's progressive, you ought to have somebody take a look at this.
Absolutely.
You agree? All right. Let me see. We had one more here regarding foam earplugs. As I've been using foam earplugs at night for many years. I've used them to black out my spouse's snoring and now to block out the sound of a CPAP machine. I've used them for decades. Doggone, the CPAP machine doesn't help everybody. Does the prolonged use of foam earplugs harm my ears?
Well, No, it predisposes you to infections and wax buildup. Normally, it's only the outer half of your ear canal that even has wax glands. But when you're putting things in your ear canal, it prevents the normal migration of wax out of your ear. So I see lots of ear infections or cerumen impactions caused by earplugs. But long term, as long as they're being changed out relatively commonly, so you don't get some horrible fungal infection from the same earplug set you've used for the last 20 years. But as long as you change them out and you're hearing okay, you're not going to cause any major issues.
I never thought about the fact that the CPAP helps the snoring, but still has more noise for whoever's sleeping with the person.
We also treat sleep apnea. Sounds like a husband-wife appointment.
Just a couple of minutes left here. What can we talk about? Who are good candidates for cochlear implants? What are the symptoms? You want to go through that again? I think this is one of the really nice things you guys are offering here.
Yeah. So if you're a patient with very severe hearing loss, and you have to have at least very severe to profound loss, and you don't have benefit from conventional hearing aids, then you are probably a candidate. There's an entire testing process involving speech discrimination and hearing and noise that insurers require before authorizing an implant. But if you're somebody that doesn't hear well and hearing aids have not helped you, then you should be worked up for a cochlear implant.
Steve, in the last minute, let me ask you a question. What are patients that are out there that have problems with voice or anything related to ENT that you think people delay coming in that ought to come in quicker? What are the kind of patients you wish you'd seen a little bit faster? What kind of problems or symptoms might they have?
Progressive hoarseness. Mm-hmm. Hoarseness that is not improving after 2 or 3 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
I can't tell you how many patients I've seen 2 to 3 months out that come in with this kind of hoarseness, and we look and we find something unfortunate like laryngeal cancer.
Mm-hmm.
Very real possibility. This is one of the things that I diagnose not too infrequently.
This may seem off the subject, but human papillomavirus is clearly associated with cervical cancer. And my gestalt is, when I talk to ENT, that it's also associated with a lot of head and neck cancers. But that has not become the official reason for trying to goad people into getting the HPV vaccine. How much laryngeal cancer is possibly related to HPV infection?
It's rising.
Okay. So it is thought to be a cause.
Significantly. You know, traditionally it's been smoking and heavy alcohol use that have been the highest associations with what they call squamous cell carcinoma, the most common cancer. But HPV is on the rise. I've had several patients this year even, otherwise healthy and remarkably young that,
mm-hmm. that present with progressive hoarseness.
Yes.
In
throat pain.
In particular.
Yes.
All right. My thanks to today's guests, Dr. Steve Schaefer and Dr. Mark Lorenz. If you want to continue the discussion on these disorders, you can join KSKA on Facebook. And you can find our link to the website and to Facebook at alaskapublic.org. On the next Line One, we're going to explore heroin abuse and addiction in Alaska and also look at the public health implications. To learn more, why not join me next Monday at 2 p.m. on FM 91.1 Alaska Public Media. Pat Yak is our chief content officer at Alaska Public Media. Dave Waldron graciously engineered today's program. And Evan Erickson is our web editor. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard. Have a great day.
Line One is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and do not reflect the underwriters or KSKA. Learn more about Line One and listen online at alaskapublic.org.